Today is October 25th, and I have the great pleasure of interviewing Molly Hallowell for a series we're doing at Trinity Soulberry Church. So I will start with the first question. And where I'm going to begin, what was your grandfather's occupation?
Well, naturally, I had two grandfathers. But one of them died back in before 1920, so I really didn't know him. But my mother's father was a station master and postmaster out at a teeny little village in Adams County. And he lived by the train schedule. He'd go home for breakfast and go back to sort the mail and see the stuff on the freight train. And they say that if anybody came when he was eating his breakfast or his lunch and wanted their mail, he would stop and go down and get it. So he was a nice, jolly old man.
Oh, that's wonderful. And Adams County was in Pennsylvania.
Yes, it's near Gettysburg is where they live.
Oh, I see. Where did you spend your formative years, say 4 through 12?
I spent my formative years up until 17 on a farm in Lower Bucks County. My dad was a dairy farmer. We had a small dairy farm, and that's where I grew up.
And were those happy years?
They were very happy indeed. Of course, that was part of it during the Depression, but my brother and I never knew there was a Depression going on. We just thought everybody lived a little tight that way, and of course there was always food and milk to drink when you live on a farm. So it was a very happy time.
Did you have other animals on the farm besides cows?
Oh yes, yes. Of course there were horses. We had horses up until, I guess, about the time of World War II. We had tractor before that, but we had a hired man that didn't drive the tractor until later on. So he'd run the horses, and my father would drive the tractor. And when I was in 4-H Club, I had pigs as my project, and I enjoyed raising pigs for a few years. And then there were chickens and ducks, stuff like that around.
Oh, that's wonderful. What schools did you attend in lower grades and then high school? And
well, when I was very small, I was very cross-eyed. And so it was decided I wouldn't start school in first grade. My mother had been a school teacher and she taught me. So my brother and I started at the same time at a little friend's school in Falsington, Lower Bucks County. And he started in first grade and I started in second grade. And we went to that little school for 2 years, and then we went to the Langhorne Middletown Public School for the rest of our elementary school, and then I went to George School as a day student. So.
And was there a teacher who influenced you for better or for worse, or transformed your thinking in one of these schools?
Well, when I was in sixth grade, I had someone named Madeline Powers. And I think she did a lot, taught me a lot of things. One thing, I had never been exposed to music. And it was around sixth grade that I at least learned to read musical notes. I'm very glad I did. How could I have gone through life without it? Also, there was a woman in Langhorne that taught musical instruments. And this was during the Depression, and so she had this arrangement where if you would take lessons from her for a year, she would give you the instrument free, which appealed to my situation. So I took mandolin lessons for a year and learned more about musical notes. And while I never have done a great deal with music, I am very thankful that I at least can read music and know what it's about and have enjoyed have enjoyed it very much. When I got to George School, there was a music appreciation class I took.
Oh, that's wonderful. Was George School located where it is presently located?
Oh, yes, it was. It's about 4 miles from my dad's farm. And in early days, in the beginning when I was going there, of course, someone had to take me back and forth, and then presently my brother back and forth. But as soon as I got my driver's license, why, that was my job, was to get us back and forth to George School. So, and there were a lot of things I missed as a day student, things that were special evening or early evening things that I just wasn't there for. Of course, we stayed for athletics that were in the late afternoon, but that would be the end of our day at George School.
Yeah. When you were an adolescent, what did a food store look like? Now, that question doesn't really apply very well to you because you probably grew things that you ate.
Well, that's true, but on the subject of food stores, down the road in the little village of Woodburn, there was a general store, and we bought things there like bread and dried beef. I remember going down and getting a packet of quarter of a pound of dried beef for 25 cents, I think, and bread was, I don't know, it was a dime a loaf for what it was, but there were those things we had to get. And then in those days there was a huckster that came around. I think he came twice a week, and he had all this things in his vehicle, in his truck, and we would occasionally get fish from him, and he would have some vegetables in the wintertime that we wouldn't have. And Mr. Hilburn, we always look forward to him coming and getting a few little things from him. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. What was your first adventure on your own?
Well, on my own, I don't know how much you call it my own, if you mean away from my parents.
Yes.
I was very fond of, very active in 4-H Club, which, you know, was at that time was for children and country farm children. Of course, now it's spread to suburbs and urban areas too. But I was very active in the 4-H Club, and every year there was a big 4-H week out at Penn State, and we'd have a busload of people that would go from Bucks County. And so I guess I was probably 13 or 14 when I first went on one of the buses out to Penn State for 4-H week, which was a real, real thrill at that time. And I went maybe 3 or 4 times before I before I was in college. And then, so that would really be about the first I was on my own.
Did you look forward to these things, or were you kind of scared?
I don't remember being scared, no. To go back even further, when I was 9 years old, I guess, it was decided that I should go to Camp Onus. That's a friend's camp. It's still in action, as a matter of fact. And so I went to Camp Onus for a week, and I thought it would be wonderful because it was at that point it was on the Chamonix Creek, and we could go swimming every day. Well, I was very disappointed. I would wake up at, I don't know, 6:45 or 7:00 when I was used to getting up at home. No one would get up, or they weren't supposed to get up, I guess, until 7:30. So I'd lie there and wish I was home. Then I would start crying, and by the time I went to breakfast, I would be red-eyed and nose stopped up. So then the nurse would look at me and say I'd have a cold and I couldn't go swimming that day. And so by the next morning, I would be that much sadder and that much broken up. So if that was the first time I was on my own, that one didn't work very well.
Oh, it makes for a good story. What was your first job?
My first job? Well, when I graduated from George School, I was planning to go to college in the fall. I needed to work that summer. And my mother knew somebody had something or other at the Woods School, which is located in Langhorne, the school for people with mental disabilities and that sort of thing. So she arranged for me to have a job that summer at the Woods School. So the first day I went, I was in a big, great, big, huge dining room where all these kids were eating. But after that, I was assigned to the faculty dining room, where the faculty ate their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I would drive in. I guess I could drive by that time, or maybe my mother took me, I can't remember. And I'd be there for breakfast, and then go home and come back for lunch, and then come back for dinner. And I did this all summer, 2 months at least. And I know these were bad times. I know this was still in the 30s. But at the end of the summer, they collected a tip for me. And the tip was $8. I felt as though I was not really appreciated.
Oh, my. Oh, so you didn't have a salary at all?
Yeah, I had a salary.
Oh, you had a salary.
I had a salary, yeah.
But the tip was
$8. I got $13 a week. And that was like, you know, for three meals a day, and it was either 5 or 6 days a week. Oh. It was not a very lucrative position. But that was my first job. And in the kitchen, they had a couple of cooks in the kitchen, and one was a big, strong, red-headed woman. And she was hilarious. I remember her better than anything else about the thing, was this big, red-headed cook, and she was lots of fun.
Oh, that's a great story. Let's see. In your career, I wanted you to discuss your career because you had a very interesting career.
Well, my career is sort of divided in two parts. But what I went to college to study for and what I did and what I loved was home economics extension work. Cooperative extension is what is under all the land-grant colleges in the country. And Pennsylvania, of course, that's Penn State. In Maryland, it's the University of Maryland. And in New York, it's Cornell. So I worked for Penn State as a home economics extension person. And I would be in a county where I would work with the county agent, and I would work with the women in the county and with the 4-H clubs in the county. And my first taste of that was while I was still in college during World War II. They were needing special meetings on freezing and canning food, which was so important during World War II. Of course, they were pushing Victory Gardens and wanting people to preserve their own food. So I took one semester off from college and gave demonstrations and talks about canning and freezing food. But then when I graduated from college, I went to work in extension, and I was in Lancaster County for my apprentice years or something, which Lancaster County is a joy of a place to be. And then I went to Warren County, which is up in the northwest corner of the state. And very different, but very rural, which I liked very much. And I enjoyed being in Warren County. And then, as life moved on, I had reason to work in Delaware County, which is outside of Philadelphia. And then later on, I also worked for Cooperative Extension in Maryland, and I was located on the Eastern Shore in Queen Anne's County. And that was just a fun job. It's, I think, one of the reasons I liked it. There were no set hours. Sometimes you work all day and all night, but that was okay. And you had your own hours. You always had a good supporting staff in the office. I had some neat secretaries, and the other people I worked with were fun, and you were on your own, you made your own schedule, and it was just a great thing to do. Then the second part of my career, my professional career, was after I came back to Bucks County, and I needed to work after a while, I went to work in New Jersey for the Division of Public Welfare. And I had had some contact with people in welfare, and I was concerned about the people that are on welfare, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to learn about them. Well, this was getting into civil service, and there's lots of politics and things that aren't so nice about that. But I stuck with that for quite a long time and worked up to a fairly high position. My specialty, believe it or not, was translating federal regulations into state regulations and writing manuals and letters that explained these things. All very complicated.
Yes.
And while I worked with some very nice people, I never really liked the job very much. The one I loved was the extension job.
Now, where did you live during this time? What were the living conditions like in these various places, especially when you were in extension work?
Well, when I was in extension, I had an apartment of my own, and it was very nice once I got settled. When I went to a brand new place, like when I went to Warren County, and someone had arranged an apartment for me. It was a very strange apartment. It had linoleum on all the floors, and the heating was gas heaters that were set in the wall with, you know, actual flames. There were no shields against it. The place kind of smelled of gas, and I just wondered how I could put up with that. But fortunately, I hadn't been there very long until I got word of a very nice apartment on one of the side streets and was able to move there, and this was very, very nice. When I lived down in the Eastern Shore of Maryland and worked down there, I rented a darling little house that was sort of back on the edge of the woods and overlooking the Corsica River, and that was fun. I had my Springer Spaniel dog with me then, and this had a long lane that didn't look like it led any place, so I didn't have a lot of strangers or things coming in, and that was quite delightful. So that was a happy, happy place to live. When I was working for the Division of Public Welfare, it was after I had remarried and come back to Bucks County. So I was living at home in the home that we had down in Upper Makefield Township, and I commuted over to Trenton or wherever the place, later out Quaker Bridge to work. So.
I know that one of the things that you love most are your cars that you had. Tell us how many cars you've had and what your first car was.
Well, I have a list of 13 cars that I guess I'm on the 13th now. But when I needed a car, when I got out of college, I had to have a car for my extension job. So, let's see, that was in 1945, but of course they weren't making cars during World War II. So, I got a 1938 Chevy Coupe, and that was very satisfactory, and I drove that, and then my brother and I were taking a little vacation trip up to New England just before I went out to Warren. Unfortunately, a great big truck sideswiped us. And so I had this battered front fender, which looked horrible but didn't affect the car going. And there really wasn't much way to get it fixed right at that point. So I went out to my new job in Warren with this old Chevy with this really, really smashed up fender. Then I put my name in immediately for a new car, excuse me, which I got in 1948. So that was that was my first car. Over the course of time, I've had a couple of Thunderbirds, not new ones, but used ones. And right now, I'm driving a Thunderbird. It's a 1990. It's got 130 miles on it, but I love it dearly. 130,000 miles on it, but I love it dearly. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you have lived in fascinating places under all sorts of conditions. And so why don't you tell about your experience of living in Alaska?
As a matter of fact, I never lived in Alaska.
Oh.
That's my family, some of my family members always thought I lived in Alaska. I lived in Western Canada. And my first husband graduated as a petroleum geologist and eventually found a job as a petroleum geologist with Saucony Vacuum, which had some headquarters in Calgary, Canada. So we went to Calgary, Canada. And then he presently was sent out in the field, and most of the time that we were in Canada, we were living in the field in Calgary, which is in Alberta, in that area, but in mostly in the Regina area, Regina being the capital of Saskatchewan. We lived on oil leases, and we'd have our housing would be a what they called the geologist, the shack, and it would be a little square thing about the size of a caboose from a train with a desk and a great big space heater and a couple of counters and a couple of beds in it. And so that's the way we lived for quite a while. Then towards the end of the time we were there, we got ourselves a nice brand new house trailer, and that was quite a relief. I enjoyed that very much. But it was pretty rugged living out there in on the oil leases, and Saskatchewan is noted for its blizzards, and we had lots of snow.
How did you do the washing?
Well, I always had to find somebody to do the washing for me, and we would get water from wherever there was a good well around. Sometimes we had to go quite a ways to find somebody that would let us fill up our can of water. But of course, we couldn't use that for laundry, so I would look for somebody who would do it, and sometimes there'd be a woman in a village nearby that was taking laundry. But I think one of the fun times was when we lived on this lease that was way out in the end of nowhere. But there was a farmhouse about a half a mile away, and I asked that woman if she'd do the laundry, and she said no, but I could come and use her equipment. So I did. But that was unique because she didn't have a washing machine. It was a little more primitive than that. And we'd fill up, she had a pump at the sink, so we'd fill up the tub, heat it on the stove. Then I could do the wash in this big tub. She had a wringer to put it through, and then rinse it in another big tub. If you did any ironing there, and I didn't iron there, but she would have to heat her irons on the stove just the old-fashioned way. So it was really, really a primitive place. But she was very, very pleasant. She was a war bride from Belgium, and I'm sure that hearing that the man she was marrying was a farmer, I'm sure she never expected anything like the prairie farms in southern Saskatchewan at that time. I'm sure she had a very different vision, but she had a couple kids, and she was very upbeat about it all, but I felt quite sorry for her.
Oh, my. Well, it sounds like you were upbeat about those
conditions. Well, that was an adventure. Yeah, I had no complaints about that. I knew it was going to be different, and it was.
Now, tell me about the house you built.
Oh, the log cabin?
The log cabin.
Well, in Warren, there's lots of forest, and Allegheny National Forest takes up a good bit of the space. And the man I married, who was originally from Warren, was very fond of the woods, and I was too, and we always talked about building the log cabin. So finally, we got the opportunity to do it. We got a little piece of land way out. It was landlocked out in the forest, but there was an old logging trail into it. And so we ordered logs, and we got a digger in there that dug out the foundations for us, and we got concrete in the foundations, and we got the logs delivered, and we built this log cabin. We had a couple of good books that told us how to do it, and we got all our friends to help us, and I think it was about 12 by 16. It wasn't large, but it had a neat fireplace. I did the mason work on the fireplace. And then it had a loft where we could sleep overhead, and all surrounded by the woods, and a little walk to the spring to get our water. And it was just a real woodsy little place. Of course, we got it done just about the time we left on this expedition to Canada, so we didn't use it as much as we hoped, but it was fun to have it.
And did you keep that as like a getaway or a house?
We kept it as a getaway, as a recreation place. And when our marriage broke up, because of various trade-offs and so forth, I got the cabin.
Oh.
However, living down in Bucks County, well, first in Eastern Shore of Maryland, then in Bucks County, I didn't get there very often. But I had someone looking after it for me, and I got up there a few times. And then, as time moved on, when I decided I was going to become an author, and I resigned from my job in New Jersey, I decided it was time to get all my finances collected together so I could support myself for a few years while I tried writing. So at that point, the cabin, I sold it back to my former husband, and that was the last I saw of the cabin.
Now you became an author, so tell us about the book that you the first book you published.
As I mentioned, I was doing all this manual and bureaucratese writing, and I was working for the Division of Public Welfare in New Jersey, and while I was doing that, I was taking a correspondence course on writing fiction. And that certainly was more attractive than writing all this rules and regulations I was involved with, and I was getting pretty sick of that job. So I started writing a book, and then I resigned the job in New Jersey and concentrated on the book. And lo and behold, the book actually got published. It was called The Mystery of the Greek Icon, which was based on information I had picked up when I had a nice tour of Greece one year. And that was published, and that was a real thrill. And I thought that there would be... Everyone had told me that there would be... Once you got one published, you were in, and you could get more published. But unfortunately, that publishing company was snapped up in a merger almost immediately afterwards, and so the people that would be interested in my book just completely disappeared, so I didn't get any more books published, but at least I have one. So.
Well, that's a bigger accomplishment than most people have. I know you've traveled a lot, and what culture influenced you in all your travels the most?
Uh, I don't know that I could say what culture influenced me, but it certainly has been interesting to see different cultures. One of my neatest trips was a tour of Morocco 3 years ago, which was absolutely fascinating and a very happy experience. Of course, I've mentioned that when I was in Greece, that gave me a lot of impetus to writing my book. Of all the countries I've visited, the one I've gone back to numerous times is Austria, which has always seemed to me such a friendly and attractive place. Of course, I love the mountains, and there are lots of mountains, and then these nice little villages, and people are always friendly, whether they can understand you or not. So that, I don't know whether that's a separate culture or not, but that's really my favorite spot.
What book, poem, play, or movie has influenced you?
Well, I think my very favorite author, and I'm sure it's influenced me some, is Neville Shute, who is a British author, died in 1960, but has written, 20 or so books. He is such an excellent storyteller. Most anybody would enjoy his books. Some of them are about World War II, so some of them are based in Australia. They're just good tales, so if you come across a Neville Shute, I urge you to read it. Another author I like very much is Helen McGinnis. Now, she's another British author. And I like Dick Francis very much. Now, these British authors seem to be at the top of my list. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. So I don't know whether they influence me, but they're ones I like.
But you enjoy them.
Yes.
And you enjoy reading. I
read a lot, yes. I'm not much for watching a lot of TV. I'd much rather curl up with a book and read something.
Yes. Now, I know that religion has played a large part in your life. And tell us about your birth religion.
Well, as you know, I was born as a Quaker. We call it a birthright friend, Society of Friends. That was what my parents and what my family had been from way back. So I was a Quaker up until my mid-30s, I guess, and was quite active when I was young, both in the Sunday school and in the young people's group. And then at a certain point I decided to become an Episcopalian, and I had received some very good help from an Episcopal priest when I was living in Washington, and then when I lived on the eastern shore of Maryland, that same priest turned up as the rector of the church there, and I decided to join the Episcopal Church. Then when I came back to Bucks County after trying out various Episcopal churches, I went to Trinity on the Friday after John F. Kennedy was killed. I think that was the day when churches all over the country were having special services, and that was the day I happened to go to Trinity for the first time. I liked Trinity, and I kept going back. So in 1964, I became a member of our Trinity Salisbury Church. And I can't believe that that's 42 years ago, but it is.
Well, you've obviously had a good experience at Trinity. Tell about some of the positions you've held and jobs you've done there.
Well, I guess you'd say that over the course of those 40-some years, I've done almost all the jobs at one time or another, good or bad. I can't think. The only thing that I have not done at Trinity, I guess I shouldn't even say this out loud, I've never been on the Altar Guild. when I joined the church down in on Eastern Shore, Maryland, the first thing they did, I was on the Altar Guild there. So I have had experience on the Altar Guild, but I've never been on here at Trinity. But I've been on Trinity's vestry at three different times, and the first time I was on Trinity vestry, my assignment was as property chairman, which seemed strange at the time. It seems stranger still looking back on it. But there was the time when Jack Smart had decreed that we should drop having the Christmas bazaar. And after a couple of years, we sort of all rose up and thought we should have it again. So Ron Tavis and I volunteered to be chairman for the first couple of years. So I was involved as chairman of the Christmas Bazaar. So. And I was clerk of the vestry for a period of 10 years in there someplace, which I recommend that to anybody who's interested in what the church is doing, because all you have to do is to take the minutes. You don't have to get into any of the decision. It's a very interesting way to be right inside. And then I spent quite a while as editor of Trinity Tidings, which was a fun job. And then eventually I passed it on to Carly Zaroff. But
how long did you do Trinity Tidings?
I did Trinity Tidings, I think, for 11 years.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Maybe that was 10 or 11 years.
And then tell about the books that you've written about Trinity's history.
Well, at the time that, of course, we had the big fire in 1998 and moved back into our brand new church in 2000. And about that time, there were a lot of new people who had joined while we were meeting in the elementary school, and which I think was a very remarkable and great thing. It seemed to me that they didn't know too much about the history, so I wrote a little book called Trinity Legacy, which was published, thanks to the Lowe's, and was given to all the people. There had been an earlier book, history book, called The First 100 Years, which gave me some really ancient history, and so it seemed like a good thing to bring it up to date. So it came out in 2000. So.
And then you wrote a book about the fire as well.
Well, Will Ravinas and I worked together to put together a book about the fire and the results, the aftermath of the fire. We had articles by various people and newspaper clippings and all the information about it, you know.
Well, those are very valuable things to the for the people in the church to have in all of the years going by. So you've told me how long you worshipped at Trinity. I know what I want to ask you. What do you consider your most valuable gift? And I don't mean a present. I mean...
You mean an ability?
An ability, yes.
Oh, dear. Well, I suppose, if you ask me, and you are asking me now, when I'm at a creaky old age, but I would say it's writing. I used to feel I was pretty much of a people person. Of course, in extension work, you do so much with people, and I enjoyed that, and I did that a lot. I don't think I'm as much of a people person as I used to be, but I love to write. I enjoy writing letters, enjoy writing articles, enjoy writing anything. So I suppose that's what I would say, you know.
Yes. Well, you've certainly been a gift to Trinity Church.
I don't know, but thank you for saying that.
Over the years, my goodness. They owe a great deal to you.
Well, I've known a lot of very interesting and very nice people at Trinity. There was a woman called Ann Bowers. It's one of a group of, you know, fairly elderly women when I joined Trinity back in 1964. She kind of took me under her wing, and she was really special. And of course, Tanis Page was there then, and Doug MacArthur's mother, Ruby, and Manette Taylor. It's this very neat group of, at least to me at that time, older women. They probably didn't feel any older than I do now. And then the younger people start coming in, and it's surprising to figure out that most of, well, they're not so young now, but most of them came after I did. So.
Yes.
Of course, Doug was already there.
Yes. And tell us about your family. I know you have grandchildren.
Yes, well, as you gathered, I was married twice. And the second time I married a man with three sons. At that point, they were ages 8, 11, and 13. And believe me, that had its problems.
I can only just imagine.
Anyhow, I adopted those three boys. And, of course, they're grown up now with their own families. So I have one grandson who is now in his 30s. I have four others, two granddaughters and two grandsons. And one has just started to college, another is a senior year at high school this year. The oldest one has a son named Ian Halliwell, and that's my great-grandson.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So without... What should I say? Without having any natural children of my own, I'm very blessed to have five grandchildren and a great-grandson. So.
Oh, well, congratulations on that. That's wonderful. Well, I can't thank you enough, Molly, for interviewing. Can you think of anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like
well,
to
you
share?
Well, you didn't ask me about one of the big thrills of my life.
Oh.
Which is flying an airplane.
Oh, excuse me. I forgot to ask you about that, of course.
I mean, that really is the top of the list of the most thrilling thing I ever did. That my first husband and I bought this little air coupe that we found on the back of a airport that was rusting away and needed to be loved. So while the engine was out and being brought up to date, we sanded all the body and the wings, and they were aluminum, and then the cockpit needed a new upholstery fabric on the seats and the floor, which I did on my little feather sewing machine. And in the meantime, my husband had gotten his pilot's license, and I was taking lessons, and I continued to take lessons later on in our own plane, and that still was the biggest thrill of my life. Get up there by yourself, your wings, you're just floating along, it's absolutely wonderful.
Oh.
And so I just had to be sure to add that.
I am so, my apologies, of course, that was one of the major reasons I wanted to interview you, and then it slipped my mind.
Yeah.
How many years did you fly?
Well, it was all too short a time. I suppose we had to plan the plane for maybe a couple years. I got my pilot's license, but by the time I got my pilot's license, unfortunately, our marriage was falling apart. We had to move on to other places. We had to sell the plane, and so that was that.
So you didn't fly other...
I didn't keep my license up, no. I was off to make my own way at that point, and
yes.
I didn't have either the time or the money to follow up
with. Continue.
But anytime anybody offers me a ride in a small plane, boy, I'll go.
I
like flying in small planes.
I hope Alan and Randy take you up again.
I have been up with Alan and Randy, yes, indeed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for allowing me to interview you because you're a fascinating person.
It's been a pleasure to tell you about things.
Good. Thank you.